Hi, everyone. My name is Anthony Negron, host and producer of Spark Chat, a podcast dedicated to capturing and sharing the personal and professional journeys of some of New York City's top thought leaders around education. We look to cover an assortment of topics while highlighting each individual. This podcast is generously supported by the Hive New York City Leadership Grant. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Bishop, representing Global Kids and the Youth Studies Program at CUNY. Stay tuned for after the show for additional content. Hope you enjoy. So I'm very excited to have my next guest on the podcast, as we haven't had many opportunities to collaborate, but after doing more research into her work and past experiences, I knew I had to have her as a guest. Dr. Elizabeth Bishop received her PhD in education from the University of Pittsburgh and has held positions in both formal and informal ed spaces. She is currently the adjunct assistant professor of youth studies program at the City University of New York and is a director of curriculum and outcomes evaluation at Global Kids. Bishop, thank you so much for taking the time to chat.
Thank you.
So normally, like, kind of what we do is, you know, we've done for a lot of our previous podcasts, we like to take the kind of the first beginning portion of the episode to really kind of focus on the individual. And so I always definitely like to take the time to get to know a person's past and a little bit about their upbringing. So I try to figure out different ways to kind of tap into that without saying the same exact question again and again. So I was wondering if you could share, what was your favorite age growing up and why?
I like this question. Some part of me feels like I loved all of the ages that I was growing up. I had a pretty fun and awesome childhood. So I'm from Southern Connecticut.
Okay.
And I was thinking a lot about, I'm the youngest by far in my family. My sister's 12 years older than me.
Okay.
And my brother's 8 years older.
Yeah.
So I was often like a young kid acting wild amongst a bunch of adults.
Yeah.
Acting adult wild.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of freedom in that. So, like, one of my favorite things was always the summers. We would go to, because we're from Connecticut, we'd go to Cape or Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah.
Because my parents are educators, so they had the time.
Awesome.
And they really let me be myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's photos of me in, like, a denim coat, denim jeans, like, smoking candy cigarettes.
Yeah.
And it was, like, no one ever tried to, like, really police me
right.
as a little kid. So I feel like I was allowed to be the wild child.
Yeah.
And I haven't exactly lost that.
Yeah, that's awesome. So then you kind of already hit a little bit into this. Could you get into a little detail in terms of, like, what were some of your favorite ways to spend your free time as a child?
Yeah. So, you know, although I've got these siblings, I in some ways feel like I grew up as an only child because they were both like already in college graduated or whatever.
Yeah.
And I grew up in the woods in Connecticut. So I spent a lot of time standing in the street in the dirt in front of my house with my golden retriever.
Nice.
Juggling a soccer ball. So I'm a hardcore soccer player.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't play as much anymore, but I played for like 20 years.
Wow.
And it was my whole life. And so
yeah.
I spent a ton of time because I didn't live near my friends. I lived in the woods.
Yeah.
I went to school like half an hour away from where I lived. So when I was home,
yeah,
this was like pre-internet too.
Right, right, right.
So
Absolutely.
When I was home, it was like, what are you going to do? I'd take my soccer ball out into the middle of the street and I would juggle in the street. And so I got mad good at juggling a soccer ball, but
yeah.
it was also like really meditative.
Right.
You know, because there wasn't really anywhere to go.
Yeah,
it wasn't
yeah.
even a lot of trouble to get into.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, like, yeah, 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 yeah. And where do you think your love for the sport then came from?
You know, I'm not quite sure. Like, when I started, it was just for fun. And when I started when I was like 4 or 5 years old. So
okay.
mad early. And then I was a defender.
Okay.
I mean, I kind of played all over the field, but I was a midfielder, but I was a defender. I'm not like super fast, so I was never a forward. But then folks asked me if I would be step into the goal.
Uh-huh.
And I really enjoyed being a goalkeeper.
Yeah.
And when you're a little kid, you're not allowed to be goalkeeper whole game.
Okay.
This is how they do,
right,
only
right.
half or whatever.
Okay.
But sometimes I like wanted to stay real bad and they let me. And
awesome.
So that it popped off a whole career, though. I mean, I considered going, you know, Olympic development
oh, wow.
and professional soccer.
Yeah, yeah.
I got injured and that changed things for me a little bit. But
right.
that game, like, it taught me so much. I always say to people, one of my grad students now is a soccer, you know, soccer youth development guy.
Yeah.
And I'm always talking to him about how soccer explains the world to me in
sure.
terms of communication and teamwork.
Collaboration, yeah.
Perspective,
Absolutely.
All these things.
Yeah, that's awesome. So then kind of fast forwarding a little bit, what were some of your future aspirations? Because, like, once you finished, you know, your undergrad degree, you know, what were some of your aspirations coming out of that? And ultimately, what motivated you to be actively involved in teaching and education?
So I was just talking to somebody about this and how I didn't really have a clear trajectory in front of me.
Right.
Because I was a queer kid from Connecticut, I've kind of been hopping the Metro North to New York City as long as I was allowed to. and running away and just chilling for the day, you know, not formally running away, but on a daily basis running away. And I'd hop the train to Grand Central and take the 6 to Astor Place, and then I would go sit in Washington Square Park and read literature.
Awesome.
And watch, like, the freaks walk by and feel like I could fly my freak flag, too.
Right.
And I felt, like, so much affinity with the, you're allowed to be whoever you want.
Yeah.
It, as an artist or as a writer. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a writer first, really. Mm-hmm. Like, and I always say to people, I'm, like, work in New York so that I can live here.
Yeah,
I don't live here to work here.
Right.
Although, you know, I walk the work on the day-to-day. But
absolutely.
So, as an undergrad, I actually went in to study journalism.
Uh-huh.
And I'm still, like, a huge proponent of the press as the fourth estate. But, you know, somebody in that program when I was a freshman in college said, if you don't believe in objectivity, you shouldn't be in this program. And so I left because I believe in subjectivity.
Right.
And I went into the humanities and ended up doing, like, plant studies.
Yeah.
And so I was able to do, like, philosophy, literary theory, political theory, gender studies, and somehow landed myself, like, at Carnegie Mellon to do a master's degree. Not because that was a big plan.
Yeah.
I don't even remember how that happened these days.
Yeah.
But, you know, with a degree in cultural studies, I didn't have, like, a real plan besides, like, be a writer in New York City.
Yeah.
And so I applied to be a New York City teaching fellow.
Okay.
And that's what landed me here. But the one note is, like, being an educator is pathological in my family.
Right? Okay.
So
my
dad was a science teacher, and then he became an administrator and inevitably was the president of the private school I went to.
Wow.
My mom is a librarian.
Uh-huh.
She had, like, 2 majors and 4 minors. You know, she's, like, an incredible, like, infomaniac in the right sort of way.
So
I just grew up with this. And my sister's an early childhood educator.
Okay.
Only my brother, like, escaped to go make money on the internet, you know.
But
the rest of us, it's, like, in our blood.
So
I feel like I was never going to be that far away. And to me, like, getting to teach in New York City and teach literature was everything, because I love literature and I love being able to spit it with people about ideas.
Right. That's awesome. That's awesome. All right, so now kind of shifting gears a bit, you know, there's so much different things I want to talk about. So I'm really inspired by your ability to balance so many different positions across multiple organizations, and I definitely want to allocate time speaking about all the work that you're doing. So first, can you share a little bit about your experience being involved in the Drop Knowledge Project? Kind of what were some of your biggest lessons learned and challenges you faced in your participation?
Sure. So the Drop Knowledge Project, dropknowledgeproject.org, is actually is kind of my brainchild.
Awesome.
So it is a scholarly outgrowth of some of the learning and writing I was doing when I was doing my doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
When I started that PhD program, I actually thought that I would end up doing research and writing about curriculum in particular, like in schools, because I was an English teacher and history teacher. So I wanted to study the literature of transgression and the different ways that it's taught. So, you know, that's open to wide interpretation. But during the process, a lot of folks that I was talking with in higher ed were kind of telling this eulogy or obituary about public schooling because of testing.
Right.
And I was a public school teacher, so I knew what they were talking about, of course. So I actually shifted my focus and I became interested in really thinking about what are the deep learnings that young people engage in after school and out of school spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I worked at Global Kids previously, about 10 years ago, as an educator, there were young people who would just, you ask them like something about like, well, what do you think about poverty?
Mm.
Something open, wide, thematic, important, and they would drop knowledge into the space.
Yeah.
And you could see it happen.
Right.
They would spit something that I never could have said, that I couldn't repeat, that was like uniquely them, but that was really eye-opening to the adults as well as to the other young people. And so the idea of dropping knowledge, and my friend Coco, who was a deputy director at Global Kids for a long time, would say, spit wisdom out your face. And that's what the young people were doing.
Yeah.
And so the name Drop Knowledge Project was actually an outgrowth of that learning, of my observations of young people in after-school spaces that were given free rein to really speak on the things that they cared about.
And
so inevitably, when I wrote the dissertation that became this book, Becoming Activist, the group of young people that I garnered together to do that, we were the Drop Knowledge Project New York City.
Yeah.
And it was a really small group of like 5 of them and then myself as like a punk rock researcher trying to pull in all of their, you know, multiplicity of their knowledge. And what I really like about Drop Knowledge Project is that it's still alive, although you know, my schedule makes it harder to be real deep in the work, but it has actually taken on a life of its own, which is what I would have wanted.
Right.
So Drop Knowledge Project New York City, that kind of closed out as that research closed. It wasn't like a funded mechanism for anything. It was just learning from young activists. So when I was on faculty at Ithaca College last year, 2 years ago, I was approached by some students saying, can we run a branch of Drop Knowledge Project here? So there's Drop Knowledge Project Ithaca now. And I'm in contact with the student who runs that, and they're working on sex ed and reproductive justice in K-12 spaces in that in Tompkins County. And, you know, they're doing exactly the same work. And I've got another young man in France who's a grad student, a graduate of that program, and he's looking at, like, LGBTQ rights for young people in outside of Paris.
Yeah.
And so what I'm excited about, and there's like some small ideas of moving towards Miami, LA, some other kind of urban centers, because I'm interested in a lot of spaces, but I've always been kind of uniquely like an urban ed individual, so I'm interested in seeing how it keeps growing out, because I want to give it a life of its own. It is not a top-down organization, never has been. It's like meant to be a point of convergence for youth and activists and educators who are trying to really say, not only is this important, which it is fundamentally to organize for against gun violence and things like that, but also that there's deep educational power in that work. You learn deeply when you are given the freedom and the trust that you actually have something important to research and write about and talk about. And
So besides kind of dedicating then time to, you know, be as involved with this, then what were some other challenges through the kind of like through the genesis of creating this and to kind of where it's at now?
I mean, you know, there's a few things. I think also because I'm a writer and researcher, I'm always thinking about this in terms of how are we going to communicate all of these things that we know to a wider audience in ways that keep the people whose stories are being told safe.
And
I talk about this all the time. I talk about the ethics of research and writing a lot. Because there is this way you could be very DIY anarcho about it and just publish everything anyone says. You know, like a WikiLeaks dump. But there is danger in that. And I, as a youth advocate and an educator, I'm like very cognizant that a 17-year-old might be like shot out of a cannon to talk about her, his or her status as undocumented and other people that they know, and that there could be repercussions down the road that as a 17 or 18, or even me when I was like a young researcher, like 25, you don't anticipate everything. So I'm like very cautious in those ways too. And so, you know, even when you want to do real community-driven, like extra institutional, outside of institutional spaces you want to do research, you still need to think like an institutional researcher. You know, and make sure that you're protecting all people who need to be protected. And so these young people, these undergrads in Ithaca who are doing Drop Knowledge Project Ithaca, as they got really deep into caring about sex ed in elementary school, I was like, this is dope. And my advice is you need to talk to their parents.
You need to talk
to the principal, and you need to talk to the chair of the education department. And, you know, they don't have to give you permission per se, but you should be crowdsourcing the best advice you can get about how to proceed, even if it's not institutionally regulated research that you're running.
Awesome. And definitely, if people want to learn more about that, they can visit the website.
It's a work in progress, you know. And we do have some social media, but we don't really use it a ton now. But actually, we're about to link out Drop Knowledge Project Ithaca. I just got a fresh link from them. Because what's dope is, like, they're building out their own content. So they put up a WordPress site. And so, you know, if you want to read about Drop Knowledge Project in New York City, there's some information on that, and it links to the book. And then Drop Knowledge Ithaca, it's going to link to their work right now. And so it is, as a model, as an online model, it is also an intellectual model that I love, which is it's a rhizome.
Right, so it
spins off in a million directions.
And it already has the international reach, too.
Right.
That's awesome. So then now kind of talking a little bit about some of the other roles you have, you're also currently working at Global Kids as a director of curriculum and outcomes evaluation. Could you talk a little bit about what are some of your responsibilities in that role, and what are some projects you are really excited about being involved in?
So I'm a huge advocate for Global Kids. I always have been. I was actually a public school teacher when I met Global Kids, and they pushed into my classroom. So that's a residency model. And I was an English teacher teaching English and global humanities, And when I was teaching about the French Revolution, Global Kids staff came in and they taught about the Haitian Revolution. And so it was really like rounding out people's history,
right.
the Global South, and having, you know, that kind of real talk. And so I was really drawn to the work.
Yeah.
And also the way that young people were positioned as leaders, you know, with the capacity to create change in the present. So, you know, I went to the work for the organization and then left and wrote about it and did some other stuff. And when I contacted the executive director saying, like, take me back. This is the place I want to be.
Yeah.
I had been in every other sort of environment in terms of education. I was an assistant principal at a middle school. You know, I'd done a wide range of things.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I look widely across all of these educational spaces, formal and otherwise, I was like, this is a place where you can do popular political education that is positioning people to be ethical leaders in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I do a lot of stuff there. I head up the digital learning and literacy stuff and have an incredible team of three individuals that run a lot of our digital learning programs across that, including PD. But then I also head up, you know, building out our curriculum, and that is a very collaborative process.
Mm-hmm.
The organization's grown tremendously since when I worked there previously.
Right.
It was like a staff of 30 then. We're about 100 now.
Wow.
And we're in DC as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And so trying to make sure that everything that we do, every time you walk into a space that is facilitated and run by GK, that you're going to recognize it, that it's going to have some kind of core components, that it's always going to be global and have an international affairs focus.
Yeah.
That seems like a heavy lift sometimes, but it's really not, right?
Because
when you're talking about sustainable development and you're talking about access to clean water, yeah, that's true in Bangladesh, but it's also true in East Flatbush.
Right, right.
You know, and so those connections, that's fundamentally what we're about. That's why we do that work. So, and then I do the outcome stuff. And what's great about that is, like, I'm a researcher.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't look at it solely from a, we need data in order to appease XYZ.
Mm-hmm.
Those things will always be true.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But we're actually looking at data that will, for continuous improvement purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm a researcher, I look at it in terms of mixed methods. So what is the quantitative data that we need to collect about our programs and our young people and our staff? But also, what's the qualitative and what kind of feedback cycles can we be running to make sure that everything is always getting only stronger and more... one of the DLL staff laughs at me because I always use the word robust. Make sure that it's more robust. You know, so, and I think something powerful, Global Kids is coming up on 30 years, is that curriculum and evaluation, they do go hand in hand.
Sure. Yeah,
and a lot of folks, if you don't introduce it in the right way, that's something that's never clear to frontline staff.
Right.
Right. They think they need to give a survey to young people so that someone at a desk somewhere can look at it.
Right, right.
But they don't understand the it can be positioned in a way that you don't see the use value in doing that stuff. And so ours has been very much about, well, who are the young people in the room? What can we learn from them initially? And how can we understand what they do and do not know about international governance bodies?
Right.
And then how can we move from there?
Yeah.
And how can we build out dope curriculum that they want to participate in so that subsequently, you know, they're at the United Nations for the International Day of Girls and Women in Science?
Right. Is it set up in a way then, are there separate people working on the curriculum development, separate people like developing the kind of evaluation tools and then kind of collaborating together? Like, how's that set up?
Well, we have some various leadership teams that help make some of those decisions about what works best. We have what could kind of be perceived of as divisions across the organization.
Okay.
Middle school, high school, community schools, digital learning, our DC program. But they all fundamentally are doing this, some of the same sorts of things with variations based on contracts. And so, you know, it is highly collaborative when it comes to the curricular component.
Mm-hmm.
And so I collected a ton of information from the staff. What do you want to write about? What do you like writing about?
Right.
Where's your expertise? What do you want to grow in learning?
Mm.
So I really did it in a way that positions our young staff as experts and as the people on the ground who know the most about the young people that they're working with anyway.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not for us to sit in our headquarters and to write some erudite curriculum that people don't want to run.
Yeah.
It's for staff to be like, young people love this. And so if we did this, this would be powerful because.
Yeah.
And so we build it out that way. And so we've come up with like an incredible structure for making sure we've got different kind of working groups, essentially working on our various curriculum modules.
Yeah.
The evaluation has been a work in progress, and we've worked internally and with some excellent consultants to make sure that we are adequately measuring our five outcomes around content knowledge with domestic politics and international affairs, around leadership development skills, both online and offline, and really increased civic engagement. And, you know, we have outcomes that are around graduating high school and going to college. That's something we take as super important. And we have outcomes around global citizenship, and that's like the air we breathe.
Mm.
You know, so we measure it, of course, but it's also evident everywhere.
Right.
And, you know, it's David Foster Wallace has an essay called This is Water,
mm-hmm.
and it's these fish, and they're swimming around, and they don't know what water is because they're in it. And so sometimes I'll say to people about the global citizenship, like, this is our water.
Right, right. That's a great way of pointing, talking about it. Okay, so now we're going to shift to even another hat that you wear. So you're also a part of the faculty of youth studies at CUNY. Let's imagine I was a student taking your class. What could I expect my experience to be like? And what are some skills and lessons that you would ideally like me to kind of walk away with?
So one thing that you could expect is that I always start my class on time. you know, I work all day for GK, and then I walk over to SBS to teach in the evenings because it matters to me so much. Mm. And so do all of the graduate students.
Right.
Overwhelmingly, they are full-time professionals working in the field of youth development who are going from bachelor's degrees to getting this master's in youth studies. And so they're also equally exhausted, inspired, and frustrated from their days when they show up. And so to me, it matters. I'm a critical pedagogue, right? Mm-hmm. I believe in Paulo Freire and everything I do.
Yeah.
And so I make sure that it's relevant. And I make sure that whatever we're doing is simultaneously going to position you as more of a scholar researcher in your field.
Mm-hmm.
And also that it's not going to be ivory tower removed from reality.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, last night I did one of my favorite lessons on epistemology.
Nice.
And you know, when I start talking about how do you know what you know, and you have to choose which one of those words you want to interrogate. How do you know? Do you know? Who are you? What do you know?
Right.
You know, it's like variations on vertigo a little bit, but it gets you to the heart of, depending on what you ask,
mm-hmm.
and depending on what your worldview is, what you think about knowledge creation and who gets to dictate truth in various constraints around power and all of these things, it will change what your research looks like.
Mm.
So we talked about, as an example, after we talked through all of these epistemological positions last night, we used high-stakes testing as an example.
Uh-huh.
And if you're a post-positivist, the sorts of questions you ask about testing have to do with graduation and matriculation rates frequently.
Mm.
If you're a post-structuralist, you are asking, you know, to what extent do these tests reinforce disparity and inequity?
Right, right.
And so it's the same topic. And depending on the way you frame your entry point to it, it's going to determine tremendously what methods you use
mm-hmm.
to garner new knowledge. And what I'm excited about, and I tell them this all the time, my grad students, I want them all to go get their doctorates because they're all geniuses in the field, you know, and they have all of this expertise. Both many of them came up through youth development in New York City mm-hmm. as young people.
Yeah.
Right. And we know that that's a thing. And so they've been apprenticed in it anyway.
Right.
And now they're in the work. And as adults in the work, they have lenses in all directions in terms of how things can be improved. And I believe as a researcher, critical researchers can change things for the better.
Right.
So, I mean, my classes are fun. They're high energy. But you better do your reading.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And I feel like for each of these topics, we could easily spend, you know, hours just talking more about these things. But this is definitely something to kind of give our visitors kind of some kind of surface level thought about all these different things that my guest is doing. And, you know, I definitely recommend always reaching back out to my guests if they want to learn more about these different things that we discuss. So you're also an author. You've authored already one book called Becoming Activists, Critical Literacy and Youth Organizing, and have another book on the way. You've already have so much on your plate, and I'm curious to know, what was your motivation for writing these books, and what has your process been like?
I'm a writer, so it's kind of like I can't help myself.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways, it's like the words, they either drip out of your mouth or out of your fingertips through the ink, you know?
Yeah.
And I do like ink, you know, as much as I'll use a computer as I need to.
Right.
But, you know, the first book really came out of understanding that there was a tradition of research in the early 2000s, I guess. I mean, it was built off of the late 90s, but critical pedagogy gave birth to critical literacy research,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of critical literacy research was inside of schools.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about power. This is about analyzing power, and frequently schools don't want young people to do that.
Right.
So as an English teacher, I had had an experience, and I know other English teachers for whom this is true, where you can position young people to do meaningful, deep, critical research, but when they want to interrogate things like the quality of the food in their cafeteria, sometimes people try to put a stop to that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the reason I became interested in critical literacy learning experiences in out-of-school spaces, because there's a freer space to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were texts that came out before from the same publisher that I've been working with these past two texts, called Peter Lang, that were about critical researchers in schools. And so this was a natural progression to that. So I pitched that research to them the first time in, I think, 2012 or so to see if they'd be interested in publishing it as kind of a continuation. I always recognize that I'm standing on the shoulders of giants that are trying to do work to dismantle racism and misogyny and homophobia, all of these things. And, you know, so that's where this book came from. And what I love about that book, it's a polyvocal text. So the voices of all five of the youth activists are featured prominently throughout. That's a very intentional design component. So the book that's coming out now is called Embodying Theory, Epistemology, Aesthetics, and Resistance. And I like to call it the prequel to the other book. Because the theory that is your epistemological position in the background, that stuff matters to me tremendously. I'm a theory head. I have a degree in cultural studies. Like, I understand the world through those lenses. But frequently social science research doesn't actually want you to spend a ton of time on that. So I wasn't granted a ton of freedom to write at length about epistemology when I was finishing that first book. But I had all this content already, you know? And it was kind of just brewing. It was like sitting on my, shelf, you know, and it was like waiting to be written. And some of it I had been writing forever since the days of my undergrad. And there's a great line from, I think it's from Foucault, that's about free thought from what it silently thinks and so enable it to think differently. And I love that because I feel like that's why I write. You know, like Borges says, like, you know, you write and speak so as not to die, because even though time is moving forward, every time you speak, you are like asserting your existence. And so very much so, like, that's what it comes down to. It's like, this, I needed to write this book. The cool thing that's emerged from it is actually that the guy who was my first editor has, I've just had a new conversation with him. He's launched a new press. And so there will be three new books to follow. Which is great.
That's awesome.
And they will be at least on some level, like, political essays. Other component parts will follow, but probably the first book will be a book of political essays, which I'm mad excited about. You know, he just encouraged me to... he told me I was incendiary, and he encouraged me to proceed.
That's so great. And when can we expect the second book to come out?
So I just saw the PDF proofs. They landed in my inbox yesterday. So it's close. I imagine that when it actually goes to press, maybe we're looking at November or December. It's definitely a 2018 copyright because it's already been at the Library of Congress. So because when I asked for an extension, I was told no. It's because it's coming out in 2018, no matter what, which is cool. So, you know, there was a that book is a... it's built off of, like, Deleuze and Guattari's work a little bit. There's a book called A Thousand Plateaus, and in that book, 1972, they talk about capitalism and schizophrenia. And the interplay between what they call a double articulation of light and language. So what you can see and what is not visible. What you say and what is silent. And so this book was that, and I tapped a friend of mine, a colleague who I did my undergrad with, who's a professor at Temple University, University of Arts, and some other places in Philly, photographer, mixed media. And so we did a light and language project together. And there was a gallery show that kicked off the book celebration about 2 weeks ago in Philly. and it's just exciting to me to, like, really think about, like, how can form and content really be exploded. And it's fun. I, you know, I get to, because I'm not full-time faculty trying to get tenure and publish in top-tier journals, I have some freedom about what I write about and where I get to publish. The only academic person above me is Dr. Sarah Zeller-Berkman, who invites me, you know, to think as widely as I want. I'm not writing for her. I'm not really writing for anybody besides the fact that, like, here's some ideas and let's spit it and what do you think about them?
Well, Bishop, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. I feel I learned so much from this conversation. It's really opened my eyes to a lot of things. And, you know, there's a lot more to learn as I kind of continue doing some of my research on your work. And I look forward definitely to stay connected to hear more about the work that you're doing. Is there a place where our listeners can keep up to date with your work?
I mean, the best place to find me is probably on Twitter. At Dr. Bishop Digital. So, and any other social media platform, that's my handle. You know, but there's, check out Drop Knowledge Project. That's evolving work. Certainly check out Global Kids. Check out the Youth Studies Program at CUNY SPS. If you don't have a master's degree and you care about young people, check that out. We are always looking to build cohorts of, you know, I've worked in a lot of spaces of higher ed, and I work with some of the most excited and energized and profoundly committed people I've ever worked with who are graduate students in that program right now. So there's lots of entry points.
That's so cool. Thank you again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Bishop is such an inspiration and is truly passionate about all the work she does. I want to thank you all so much for listening, and please rate, review, subscribe, and share the Spark Chat podcast. As always, I wish you all my best, and do stay tuned for additional content. Take care, everybody. All right, so for our listeners who are still listening, this is definitely the kind of section where we have these kind of really quirky questions. And so first we're going to start off with, Bishop, if you came back in your next life as an animal, what animal would you be?
This took me no time at all. I would be a dog.
Okay.
Same here. Really probably nothing better than dogs on this planet, you know? Like, people talk too much.
Right.
People got egos in the way.
Yeah.
Dogs just love you.
Right.
So I'm Year of the Dog.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's maybe something to that.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah.
I grew up with dogs.
Right.
They're just, you know, the unstoppable love.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I have a dog now. I fostered a bunch of dogs.
Okay.
Through Badass Brooklyn Rescue. Mm-hmm. And if you live in Brooklyn, you can foster with them. And fostering dogs when you're like a broke 20-something-year-old is great because the financial investment is not yours.
Right.
All you have to do is love the dog.
Right.
And so over time, I fostered 13 dogs. And one at a time.
Okay.
And the 13th dog I fostered, I became what they call a foster fail because I adopted her.
Because
I like couldn't let this dog go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she was abandoned on the streets of Alabama.
Ah.
The cutest dog you've ever seen.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like, although I rescued her, she probably saved me.
Right, right, right.
And so just, you know, I would love to be able to operate like that. I feel like dogs are like little Buddhas.
Right, right. That's great. Yeah, that would be my choice as well. What TV channel doesn't exist, even though there's so many different channels now, what TV channel doesn't exist but really should?
So although Democracy Now! Exists as a television show, I mean as a broadcast, a video broadcast, I think that there should be a channel that has independent international news 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
I learn more watching 60 minutes of Democracy Now! Every evening, and I do. I watch that at like 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So it's not exactly a wind down.
Right. Yeah.
But I wish that I could...
Yeah.
Get informed like that at any hour of the day after those 60 minutes are over.
Yeah.
So usually, you know, you've got to go read The Intercept, and I do, or listen to those podcasts. So they're amazing. But to find folks who are not beholden to corporate funding and who can actually speak the truth to power about what's actually going on places, I need more of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I would love to see Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez and, you know, Jeremy Scahill and all of them come together and create like a 24-hour
That'd
news
be awesome.
Channel
yeah.
where people could really get schooled. Because I think that fundamentally, you know, one of the anti-intellectual problems in this country is that people have not been taught well what's really happening and why you should care about it.
Mm-hmm.
They're given sound bites. And, you know, I do watch CNN frequently and it's on repeat.
Right.
I could walk out of the room, come back in, and not have missed a thing.
Right, right.
Whereas in Democracy Now!, the first 14 minutes of headlines, that's like reading three newspapers.
Right, right. That's great. That's a great idea. Well, Bishop, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you not only taking the time, but you as a person. This has been amazing, and I hope we can stay connected.
Yeah, let's do it.
Awesome.
Thank you.